Donc, je suis très heureux de passer la parole à notre collègue, le professeur Graham Barker, qui vient de l'Université de Cambridge et qui a longuement travaillé dans ce site de d'AOFTA en Libye, dont il va nous parler maintenant.
Merci. Je suis désolé de parler en français. Les images, j'espère, sont en français. In fact, I think it's a good example to follow Amri Lezine's paper, because if we're trying to understand the relationships between people and climate, the big challenge for us is to move from the global fine information about climate change down to how was it actually experienced by the kind of people that we're trying to study. And so we're all trying to piece this relationship between very fine, large-scale records and gradually trying to understand how climate change might have been experienced at the local level. And that really is what this talk is about. So the Halfatir Cave is in the Jebel Akhdar, which is Arabic for La Montagne Verte, the Green Mountain. So it is, in effect, an island of landscape that is like southern Greece and Crete, surrounded by sea and desert today. And this is how the Jebel Akhdar is. You see, the cave I'm talking about is on the coast. There's a steep set of escarpments here, and then the high plateau, it's about 1,000 meters above sea level. And then you move down very swiftly to the pre-desert and then to the desert, over a matter you can see of 60, 70 kilometers. It's a very telescoped landscape. This is the Halfatir Cave, so it's on the coast of Libya, 2 or 3 hours drive east of Benghazi, and it looks out over the sea. And it was excavated in the early 1950s by the Cambridge prehistorian Charles McBurney. He excavated a 14-meter deep trench in the middle of the cave floor. You can see this was the eventual shape of it. This here is the upper part there. And he found a sequence that, as Jean-Jacques has said, is in many ways has been unrivaled in North Africa. It's certainly one of the most important sequences, eventually published in that book in 1967. He found this sequence, he defined a set of phases. He had a classical occupation over the last 2 or 3,000 years, from Greco-Roman up to the present. In fact, here, this is the last 10,000 years. He had Neolithic and what he called Capsian of Neolithic, a Capsian like that in the Maghreb, Ibo-Marusian, which he dated, you can see here, from 7,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. He then had a late Paleolithic, sorry, that's by the Ibo-Marusian at 15,000. Below that was a European style. He was using a European style terminology and also term frames of reference. He called them the Daban period, had these blades, and he could date it back to 40,000 years ago. Below that, radiocarbon dating couldn't reach. So he had to estimate what he found below. And below, he found industries of that Levallois-Mousterian type that Shannon was talking about earlier this morning. And below that, another strange industry, which was also seen now as Middle Stone Age, but he called pre-Aurignacian because of links he saw with the Near East. And there were two human mandibles found in these Levallois-Mousterian layers, so we're down here now. Basically, the deep sounding is this number one, and these ones here, the middle part there. And at the time, because they seem very big, strong, primitive, robust, they were described as Neanderthaloid, like Neanderthal. But years ago, Jean-Jacques Hubin showed that they were definitely modern human. This is anatomically modern human, AMH. So I was invited to renew excavations at the site, and The main fieldwork started in 2007. It was funded by the European Research Council largely, and so it had this name TransNAP, standing for Cultural Transformations and Environmental Transitions in North African Prehistory. And the project, the centerpiece was the re-excavation of the Halfatere, but we did a lot of work also around the rest of the landscape. There were three main components. One was to re-excavate the cave, directed by Tim Reynolds. The other was to conduct a lot of geoarchaeology in the landscape of the Jebel Achdar, directed by Tim Reynolds. Then also we went back to the McBurney archive, that's both the paper record, the photographs, and virtually all the finds, the artifacts and the bones and so on, in the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Cambridge. So first of all, we had to find the McBurney Trench because he refilled it at the end. That's on the very first day of the project in 2007. And over the years, we re-excavated it entirely down to the 14 metres. It's obviously a huge task. Having cleaned the faces, we found the McBurney faces. It still had his metal labels down the side in many places. We then did modern recording, sampling for all the kinds of dating of the techniques that we've heard about this morning, collecting also lots of indicators to tell us about climate, environment. Tepha is volcanic ash. These are volcanic eruptions from Greece and in particular Italy, where the dust blew into the cave, very important chronological markers. And we also conducted very small scale new excavations down the side of the McBurney Trench. So this trench here, you can see just it's a 2 meter by 1 meter cut down there. And then we did a similar one down there. And we also made a very small excavation. We found more sediment below where McBurney stopped down here. We stopped in 2013 when security collapsed with the murder of the American ambassador in Benghazi. But the excavations were completed in 2015, meaning the base of this trench, the base of this trench, so we now have a continuous sequence, and I should say in the Holocene too, by colleagues from the Libyan Department of Antiquities. And I think this is a useful time to say that in periods of extraordinary difficulty, beyond anything really, in the many other difficult regions of North Africa, the Libyan Department of Antiquities have been amazing at researching the sites, conserving the sites, maintaining the sites, protecting the sites. These were people who'd worked with us all the way through the project. They undertook some further training with us in the UK, and they finished the work brilliantly. And as with all of these sorts of excavations, they're small scale, they're very slow compared to what people like Charles McBurney could do in the 1950s, because every bucket of stratified soil has to be washed and screened, and so all the organic remains are washed out like this, and then all of the residues are washed and cleaned and dried, and people then spend hours and hours and hours trying to pick out everything larger than 2 millimeters. You're aiming for that kind of extreme recovery. So as with all of these sorts of projects, the half the team, or less than half, are in the cave, and the other half are doing that kind of work. This is some examples of the geoarchaeology in the landscape. We have various pollen sequences. We have dendrochronology going back several hundred years from olive trees. We were dating ancient raised beaches of periods of higher sea level like this. We have some deep cores in what are now dried up lake basins. We conducted surveys for artifacts, archaeological survey right down into the desert. These are some of the Middle Stone Age hand axes that came from these deposits in order to make maps of where people were in different periods. And these are examples of some of the finds in Cambridge. So the work we did, we have all the records from the McBurney period, his notebooks, his records, plus you can see here photographs, sediment samples, lithics, that's the flints, the animal bones, the shells. And this is typical, a 1950s biscuit box full of lithic debitage. And that's the team that was involved, about 20 institutions, which again is typical of the kind of projects that we're talking about today. And you can see there from the range of university departments, museums and so on that the team come from. And none of these, the names matter, but just to give you a flavour of that, we have a series of different people looking, and you can see some of them have mentioned already, Rena Grun and dating, so several laboratories and several people involved in different methods of dating, several people involved in different approaches to the various kinds of artifacts, particularly the stone tools, a whole range of people from different laboratories working on different kinds of material that we've collected to tell us about climate, environment, subsistence, and other aspects in terms of things like symbolic material culture. We were able to put forward a new chronostratigraphy for the McBurney excavation. We were first able to date really the McBurney phases, taking them as if they were real phases. This is mostly by radiocarbon. We also had these techniques talked about OSL dating of feldspar, which can take you much earlier. And these were published in a second paper here. And the headline result really was the Howard-Fatir sequence. As I said, McBurney could date it back by radiocarbon to about 40,000, and he thought it went back to 80,000, and actually now we know it goes back to about 140,000. And you've seen these charts before, this world global climate model or reconstruction of today's climates here, similar climates in this MIS-5, the interglacial periods that have been talked about with phases, and then these extraordinary changes through getting right down to this coldest period, the last glacial maximum that we heard about from Anne-Marie. So we had a set of sedimentary phases dated, and then these were the McBurney phases in terms of where he placed them in the stratigraphy. We were able to define a set of fasces, sedimentary types, five major ones published by Robin Inglis for her PhD, right the way through the sequence from the bottom to the top, and broadly they correlate in a broad way with these global climate stages that you've heard about, the marine isotope stages. So we have down the base of the trench that deep sounding sediments that formed in warm, humid climates, and then there was a period of dramatically oscillating climates that are broadly placed in what we call MIS-4. And so what you see here are these sediments changing from warm and humid to dry and changing like that. And then gradually the dominant feature is it got increasingly cold and dry. And so what mostly you're seeing here are stones coming down from the cave roof in cold, icy conditions, breaking off from the cave roof. And then the last 10,000 years, this is this earlier period that Amory talked about when it was wetter than today. And then it became drier, and there's increasing signs of human activity, human presence, culminating with animals being kept in the cave. So that's at the big scale, but this also gives you an example of the small-scale reconstruction we were trying to do. You've seen some of these images before of this technique of micromorphology, where a block of sediment is taken out, and then it's impregnated with wax, and eventually a glass slide is cut through it. So what you're seeing here is a piece of this 14-metre sediment, perhaps 10 centimetres of the 14 metres of the Howard-Fatir, and we have a sequence more or less continuous down most of it. And you can see here, just from this tiny little window, apart from fragments of dung, fragments of bone, but also Robin Inglis's interpretation, this is a period when there was still water, standing water in the cave, and then there were some kind of flood events, weather's changing, water's washing in floods, it goes back to being still water, then there's some kind of hiatus and flood events again. So you can see the task of us trying to move from these kind of specifics to these big world models, and to understand human behaviour to it. And the very fine-scale excavation brought out things that McBurney observed some and not others. Different kind of of contacts and changes in the trench sequence. And what these add up to is that whereas the original idea, we see the same climate model, is you had those periods that I talked about, pre-origination and so on, all the way through here. This was the original idea. And then what we can actually see is that there are major sedimentary and occupation hiatuses. So the Haarfortier was known as one of the longest continuous occupation sequences in North Africa. It's one of the longest discontinuous occupation sequences in North Africa. And that is probably typical of most cave occupation sites, indeed in many parts of Europe as well in this period. So what you can see, we know that there were occupations earlier in the deep sounding, this pre-origination, the MIS-5 period, and then there's a phase of Levallois-Mousterian, nothing, a second phase of Levallois-Mousterian, nothing, then this Dabon period, the beginning of these upper Paleolithic type blades, a big gap, another phase, and then the later ones not shown there. So that's a very crude version I did last night of that is the reality of this kind of deep cave, of a set of occupations of different types punctuated by short hiatuses, hiatuses of a couple of thousand years, hiatuses of 20,000 years. And just to go very quickly through what's emerging from this story, down in this deep sounding, we're dealing with this period, this MIS-5, the last interglacial. We have the first human presence, these MSA industries that McBurney called pre-origination. And we know that there were these major wet and humid phases within MIS-5, punctuated with phases that were more arid, colder and more arid. And the OSL dates fit these episodes, and you can see them here in the stratigraphy, and you can see them here too. So it looks like in this period, when it's the Green Sahara we just heard about, and then you had periods of comparative dryness and back again, people are clearly coming to the cave at this time. What are they doing? Well, also, who are they? The mandibles that Jean-Jacques looked at come from immediately above at the top of this sequence. So we have to try to argue without fossils that these are probably the same modern humans. They're hunting Barbary sheep, which was the main wild goat, it was the main prey all the way through the sequence. Gazelle, aurochs, hartebeest. They were fishing. It's clear that we have large fish, which cannot be fish that could have, say, been brought up by birds. There are fish bones in the cave. They were collecting shellfish. They were collecting land snails. We think there's some evidence that they're collecting plants. There are these perforated shells right down at the bottom, and these are these tools. So it seems to be some kind of coastal humid phase adaptation in this island, this Jebel Akhdar island, by modern humans, because there's nothing really like it to the west or in the desert or the south or the east. Then it looks as if we now move into MIS-4, this period 71 to 57,000. This is this period of these dramatically fluctuating climates. There are the indicators of increasing aridity, and then we have people who have this Levallois-Mousterian technologies that we heard about later, this Levallois technologies. They're in that period. This is the period of the Homo sapiens mandibles. There's evidence for this massive burning of hearths. We think it may be burning grass. It's very unclear why, but it's a big, thick level at this time associated with them. There are hints of these Aterian technologies that we've heard about, and we don't understand them, but at the fine detail of excavation, it looks like we can see Levallois-Mousterian lithics in the wet phase, different kinds of lithics in the dry phase, in particular the beginnings of these Dabon blades, back again to Levallois and Mousterian. McBurney himself thought he could see mixtures, and we think we can see some kind of relationship between technologies and climate in this changing period. But then there's a hiatus of 15,000 years. Nobody's in the cave as far as we can see. And then people have come back again with the same technologies from 50 to 42,000 years ago. and then there's another hiatus. And so the questions for us is it simply that people are using another cave a kilometer away, or is it that we are seeing genuine failure to adapt to climate changes and so on, these terribly small-scale populations that we're talking about all today, communities which would have been as big as the number of people here, not the number of people here, separated by huge distances, are these periods where the Jebel Akhdar as a whole is abandoned? And then we move to this next phase that we heard is, we see phases of increasing aridity, but as we can see, we also have, as we saw, it's not a simple story of increasing aridity, as we saw in the previous talk. After this long hiatus, people come back in this period, 40 to 1,000 years ago, with these Upper Paleolithic, Late Stone Age in the African literature, blade industries. We have isotopes from the teeth of the animals that they were hunting, which tells us about significant aridity. But also people are here, what these are the land snails that people were collecting for food. And you can see these punctuated episodes when people are there. These are microscopic evidence from the micromorphology of bone fragments, phytolith-rich dung. Phytoliths are small pieces of plants, and trampling, perhaps humans and animals, we don't know. But there seem to be dramatic changes in technologies, which we heard about too, of people developing ways of hunting better in more difficult, meaning more open landscapes. People have studied the damage on the ends of the tools, and the points have got impact damage where they've been striking animals. And at the base of these Daban lithics, Giuseppina Mutri has found the striations, the marks of the hafting, and also the fiber, the string bindings around. Clearly, we're dealing with some kind of projectile points. She also had evidence for scraping wood, perhaps making wooden tools as well, and cutting plants, and new strategies for dealing with increasing aridity. And they included seed and nut processing. This is one of the grinding stones from this period, well dated to 31,000, it's now been published, where there are use wear on it and organic residues on it. They're grinding seeds, particularly of this goat grass, and they're also grinding up pine nuts on the stone. And these things presumably take a lot of time to collect. They're hard work, but they're becoming, if you like, necessary. It's an important resource that's now being collected. And indeed, this story from the Hawafatir around that sort of period, around 30,000, in many other different parts of the world, there's similar evidence of people also now using these difficult to process, slow to process. You can see here, compared to the effort to get acorns, to get roots, to get tubers, it's a lot of work for not much, but clearly it's an important part of how you survive. Then there's this hiatus between the early and the late Daban of 8,000 years, something like so. And then people start to reuse the cave again. And this is now around the last glacial maximum, this period of maximum aridity, the most difficult times in many ways for many of the human populations around the world. And yet, amazingly, this was the time we know people are into Siberia, they cross into America, and they've got, it's a period of extraordinary expansion across the world, well into Australia by now, long in. What we find in this period of maximum aridity, it's actually also the period of the most intensive use of the cave. And you can see here, we have very strange, in the excavations here, we found a whole series of post holes. There's some kind of wooden structures. We don't know what they mean. Are they making shelters inside the cave, but the cave gives them shelter? Are they things to do with wooden structures for hides, for scraping hides, for drying meat? We don't know. We haven't found them before, we haven't found them afterwards. Hunting and gathering at this time, the same work on use wear and the residues, hunting, hide working, plant processing, the study of the animal bones, all year round hunting, intensive butchery, The land snails, intensive collection of these as a plant food as well. The shellfish too, people are now collecting them all year round, where it was a seasonal activity before and it was to become a seasonal activity afterwards. And there's evidence that there was also overpredation. The shells get smaller because they're not having time to grow before people are collecting them. And they're also gathering plants and they're storing plants. There's another technique of ways of dealing with aridity. We have all of these different sorts of evidence, the pine and other sorts of vetches and so on like this, juniper, acorns, grasses, legumes, fruits, pine kernels. So these things, they're like fruits, they're learning how to cut them, to dry them, and also they're probably storing the pine in these whole cones and then putting them into the fire to release them. So it looks as if at this period of maximum aridity, when it looks like the Sahara around was abandoned, around the Jebel Akhdar, the populations are highly centralized here, and there seem a number of pointers that this may have been a refugium for quite isolated human populations. Isolated in one way, but actually, again, this enigma, it's actually the tools now, the toolkits these people are using, now look extremely like those in the Maghreb. And so how these connections are, we know that the Gulf of Sirte between the end of the Maghreb and the here is one of the most difficult regions to cross on Earth and was so then. And yet this is a period when there seem to be connections, one of the rare times when there seem to be connections across North Africa. We saw this figure earlier, the Cooper model. In fact, there were earlier periods, and what that study suggested in the western desert part of Egypt is in the driest periods, the end of the Pleistocene, people had to concentrate in the Nile Valley. Then in that humid early Holocene period, people were able to spread out. And then gradually, as it started to get more desert, this is 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, people were concentrating more. That's really been the main general model. In fact, we're unclear how much the Jebel Akhdar was affected. What these show, this is a study of phytoliths. These are a PhD student working on the bird bones, and these are these are where the birds are coming from, excluding the birds that have lived and died in the cave. So we have here woodland, semi-desert, wetlands all the way through. And what we can see is early on, the early Holocene, this is between 12,000 and 8,000 years ago, birds from open woodland, semi-desert, wetlands. So the birds from the cave are able to reach up onto the Jebel and down. And then as it later, more open, less woodland. And then gradually it does generally get much drier later on. And what we see then in this period, there are no extreme climate shifts that we can see. It was a landscape of trees and shrubs. It later became more open vegetation. People were now collecting shells, the marine shells, just in winter, and this is when we get particular signs of resource stress, gathering wild grasses, hunting much as before. Domestic sheep and goat appear after 8.2 thousand, and that's known as the 8.2 event, which was a short, sharp phase around the world of a climate deterioration. And for whatever reason, it's soon after that we have the bones of domestic sheep and goat in the cave, and there are arguments about whether these people acquired sheep and goat, domestic animals, from the Egypt and the Levant, where they came from ultimately, or possibly from the populations in the Sahara. And there's no evidence for cultivation. This is one of the small caves we also excavated. It's a little cave on the coast, small excavation, 2 meters by 1 meter. But you can see here, the same as McBurney found in the Haafetiya, this Mesolithic, Neolithic. They're extraordinarily the same. Virtually everything's the same, apart from there are some bones of domestic sheep and goats. So you can see here the lithics, The bits of animal bone, the shells that were being collected, it's really a hunter-gatherer mode of subsistence combining after 8,000 years ago in ways we don't understand how, keeping sheep and goat. And that's a common pattern across much of North Africa, apart from in the northwest Maghreb, where there is evidence for cereals appearing, probably from Spain, but actually also they seem to be a tiny, tiny percentage of the way people lived. So the first appearance of domestic sheep and goat after 8.2, no evidence for crop cultivation. They were harvesting wild plants like sorghum. And only in the Greco-Roman period, only with the coming of the Greek colonies, the last 1,000 years BC, is the present landscape there. The landscape of cereals, of olives, of sheep and goat and so on, that's really only 3,000 years old in the Jebel Akhdar. So that's a run through this sequence that's emerging from the cave. It is one of the major deep archaeological histories. As I said, it's a punctuated story, not a continuous story, as it's been regarded, but it's a much more interesting story. I didn't talk much about this complex history of cultural interactions. I haven't talked much about that. But what I have tried to talk about is the way humans responded to climate change was complicated. And in a way, this is the kind of work that archaeologists are producing in other parts of the world and also in different periods to say that we can learn from the past, but the past is complicated because we are a complicated species. We perceive things like climate change in different ways and different times. We're capable of taking wise decisions, capable of taking stupid decisions. And this story of the cave, in some ways, is probably telling us something of that, of successful adaptations. I sometimes think that archaeologists are prone to describe the past as if it's a record of success. And of course, the failures also result in the lithics that we find, as well as the successes. So it is an interesting story. And it's a story that contributes to a lot of efforts by a lot of archaeologists to try to understand this relationship between climate change and human responses, which of course has a modern resonance as well. Thank you.